maybe Barbara Lee will win. Maybe when that competition is held, maybe when the open primary is held, of all the major candidates, voters will say, look, we like Barbara Lee's policies best. We're willing to overlook the fact that it's not really a generational change, and we're going to go for Barbara Lee. But she's got to earn that. I don't think anybody has the right to say, I'm going to be the next U.S. senator. You've got to work to be the next U.S. senator. And that goes for LaFonza Butler. It goes for Adam Schiff. It goes for Katie Porter. It goes for Barbara Lee. So I think, yes, Newsom's going to attract some flack for this choice. But I think overall, he did something politically smart. And he did something that really is going to help keep the Senate functioning over the coming months.
Interesting choice. On the one hand, she was a union leader, represented home health care workers for the SEIU in California. More recently, of course, an advisor to Kamala Harris, the vice president, and advised Uber as it fought the California law requiring app companies to grant workers employee benefits.
Yes, she did. And I think when we come to the primaries, if she decides to throw her hat in the ring for the 2024 Senate race, when it comes to the primaries, that's certainly something that's going to be discussed. Because you're right, she has a very progressive track record with the SEIU, which is one of the better and most progressive unions in California, extremely effective. And yet at the same time, as you said, she's been on the wrong side of this issue with Uber. And, you know, California has had a whole bunch of labor disputes. It's had a whole bunch of legislation around labor. And it's had this initiative that was trying to essentially treat Uber drivers and Lyft drivers as employees, which they are. They should get benefits. They should get paid sick time. They should get health care. They should get retirement. And they don't. And she's lobbied very hard on the side of Uber against that policy change. So I do think that come the primary, that's going to be something she has to talk about. If she decides to run for the Senate, she is going to have to prove her progressive credentials. I think there's no doubt about that. But I think she also has a very strong record over most of her career around union issues, around progressive issues that are dear to progressives' hearts in California and elsewhere. I think she's a very credible senator.
Sasha Abramski, can you talk about the legacy of Dianne Feinstein?
It's huge. And, you know, you don't have to agree with everything she did or every policy statement that she made. But over the course of 50 plus years, she was a central presence in California politics. She was the mayor of San Francisco. She was one of the most effective senators in California history. She had some huge policy accomplishments. She took on the gun control law, the gun lobby, and she introduced significant gun control of high velocity, high power weaponry. And that was effective. It's now lapsed, and we're now seeing the consequences of that with these ghastly mass shootings. But in its day, her gun control measures were effective. She took on the CIA in the aftermath of 9/11, when there was this sort of worldwide torture network at these CIA-run black sites. She took that on, and she forced Senate Intelligence Committee hearings, these huge hearings that resulted in this mammoth report exposing just how deep the torture rot had gone. I think...
I mean, this is extremely significant because she was actually going against President Obama, who didn't want the report released, and she was pushing for it. I wanted to go back to December 2014, the Senate Intelligence Committee releasing that summary of its investigation into the CIA's post-9/11 torture campaign. Senator Feinstein, at the time chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, outlined the report's key findings.
First, the CIA's enhanced interrogation techniques were not an effective way to gather intelligence information. Second, the CIA provided extensive amounts of inaccurate information about the operation of the program and its effectiveness to the White House, the Department of Justice, Congress, the CIA Inspector General, the media, and the American public. Third, CIA's management of the program was inadequate and deeply flawed. And fourth, the CIA program was far more brutal than people were led to believe.
So that was, at the time, the Senate Intelligence Committee chair, Dianne Feinstein. Ultimately, though, she would support the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Your final thoughts, Sasha?
Yeah, look, when I heard her speak in 2014 at those Senate Intelligence Committee hearings, I thought it was one of the most effective policy interventions I'd ever heard, because she laid it out to the American public, the moral stakes of going down this torture road. Now, that said, you're right. She was on the wrong side on a whole bunch of other issues. She's a complicated figure, but my overall thoughts on Dianne Feinstein, I thought she was an extremely powerful presence, an extremely dignified presence, and I thought the last few years of her life were tragic, and I wrote about it quite extensively for The Nation. There was nothing that anyone could take pleasure in watching her decline over the last few years. She should have retired on a high note in 2018. She would have gone out with an absolutely extraordinary record. She decided to run for re-election. She ran, she won. And then the last few years were a very public slow decline, a physical decline, a cognitive decline. She clearly needed help performing basic functions in the U.S. Senate. And it was humiliating and it was embarrassing. And I don't think
And the question was really, in the case of Dianne Feinstein, was it her? Was she capable of making these decisions? Or perhaps was it those who wanted to ensure that if Gavin Newsom made that promise for an African-American senator, that he did not choose Barbara Lee at the time, the three people who were running for that office, Nancy Pelosi in particular, whose oldest daughter became the sort of protector of Dianne Feinstein, and not wanting Barbara Lee of these three candidates when Pelosi's choice was Adam Schiff to replace her as the senator from California.
Yeah, I think there were clearly behind the scenes machinations going on. That was very apparent. And there were negotiations going on behind the scenes around what would happen if and when she either retired or died. But I think none of that negates the fact that, you know, watching a public figure decline in the way that we watched Dianne Feinstein decline over the last few years, it was really sad. And, you know, coming back to what I was saying, I don't think anyone did, and I don't think anyone should take pleasure in watching that. It was a real sort of terrible ending to a storied career. She clearly wasn't performing at 100%. She clearly wasn't representing California at 100%. And by the end of her life, you know, there were these daily stories of confusion, of inability to sort of navigate the process and the system without, you know, extensive help from her aides. And I think it was very humiliating. And I think also it was a very public display of the risks of gerontocracy. You have so many senators, so many congressmen, you have so many top political officials who are very, very elderly. And the way the Senate works in particular, it privileges seniority. And so there's no incentive to retire. And I think, you know, we should have a national conversation about this. And I think Dianne Feinstein's last couple of years in office really should trigger that conversation.
Sasha Abramski, I want to thank you for being with us. West Coast correspondent for The Nation, author of several books, his forthcoming one on the Trump era. We'll link to your pieces for The Nation and Truth Out. When we come back, October is National Domestic Violence Awareness and Prevention Month. We'll look at the remarkable story of a domestic violence survivor, Tracy McCarter, a nurse and grandmother jailed after her husband died of a stab wound when she defended herself during an altercation. Her imprisonment sparked outrage across the country. Back in 30 seconds.
You all appreciate it. When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the streets. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school, I'm scared to go home. I was a fool with the big boys breaking all the rules. Shed tears with my baby sister. Over the years, we was poor than other little kids. And even though we had different daddies, the same drama with...
Dear Mama by Tupac Shakur. 25 years after his killing, a suspect was arrested and charged in Las Vegas Friday with Tupac's 1996 murder. Dwayne Keith Davis wrote in his 2019 memoir, he provided the gun used in the drive-by shooting. Police said Davis, quote, was the shot caller for this group of individuals that committed this crime. That was the murder of Tupac Shakur. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. October's National Domestic Violence Awareness and Prevention Month. We spend the rest of the hour looking at how the criminal justice system disproportionately criminalizes Black and brown survivors of domestic abuse, and how activists have been organizing to win their freedom. The Vera Institute of Justice reports 77% of women in jail have experienced intimate partner violence. Here in New York, 90% of incarcerated women have faced domestic violence. And New York's own data shows a third of women imprisoned in New York for homicide were abused by the person they killed. Today, in her first broadcast interview, we're joined by Tracy McCarter, a survivor of domestic violence, who was the focus of a campaign called I Stand With Tracy that led to a remarkable courtroom scene in New York City last November when Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg asked a judge to dismiss the second-degree murder charges against Tracy, who says she stabbed her estranged husband in self-defense when he attacked her in her New York City apartment in January 2020. It was Tracy who called 911, but she was immediately arrested. Tracy spent nearly 7 months at the Rikers Island jail complex until she was released thanks to pressure from a successful solidarity campaign. This is Bragg's exchange with Judge Diane Kiesel. Listen closely.
What you want to do now is to dismiss this case outright. Is that correct?
This remarkable scene played out after a campaign to support Tracy, led by groups like Survived and Punished, that included a call to pack the court. Her case drew attention after the New York Post reported on it. Then journalist Victoria Law contacted Tracy McCarter in prison and wrote a piece for Gothamist about her that was then shared by several candidates in the Manhattan DA's race, including Alvin Bragg, who you just heard from in that clip, who wrote, "I stand with Tracy, prosecuting a domestic violence survivor who acted in self-defense is unjust." But Bragg did not move immediately to drop the charges once he was elected. It took nearly another year of pressure. For more on the story, we're joined by Tracy McCarter herself. She's a registered nurse who just graduated from Columbia University with a master's and just received the Truth Out Center for Grassroots Journalism's Keeley Shenhua Memorial Essay Prize for her essay, "As a Black Woman Accused of Killing a White Man, I Was Never Innocent Until Proven Guilty." Tracy McCarter, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to Democracy Now! I summarized your case, but most importantly, we want you to tell it in your own words. Take us back to 2020 until today.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you for having me. You know, one of the first things that a person loses when they become a defendant is their voice. Everyone tells you to keep quiet, and so I really welcome this opportunity. In March of 2020, I was living apart from my spouse because he had relapsed on alcohol and he would be violent. And when he was drinking, his violence would lead to attacks that included choking. As a nurse, I knew exactly how dangerous strangulation is to anyone, to a domestic violence victim. It is considered the most dangerous form of domestic violence. And when he wasn't drinking, I would try to say to him, "Listen, you can't do this. This is so dangerous to me." But he would drink. He would not be, you know, able to be in control of himself. And so I had to move myself away. I had done that. I was living on the Upper West Side in an apartment by myself when he contacted me that day while I was at work. And I immediately shot off an email to his father to say, "Oh my gosh, Jim is drinking again. I don't want to help him, but I don't know what to do." And the reason I was so distressed is because Jim would come to my apartment regularly, and he would ring the doorbells of all the neighbors until someone let him in. He would come into the building. He would harass people. He would fall asleep or pass out in front of the door. And the building management was threatening to kick me out, even though I wasn't responsible for his behavior. And so I felt desperate that if I was going to find a way to escape him for good, I needed to help him. And so I let him into the apartment that night because he had asked me for help getting back to sober living. And instead of doing that, immediately upon entering my apartment, he started saying, "Give me money, give me money." And I was not going to give him money to help him keep drinking. And what followed was, you know, he rebuked an offer of medication that would have helped him. And he went further into my apartment, grabbed my purse, came back down the hallway, and we end up in a struggle over the purse. And he then proceeds to attack me, which included a choking episode. And it ended up that he came away with my purse. He was by the door. I was further inside of the apartment, and I wanted him to get out. I was so desperate for him to leave. He wouldn't leave. Neighbors heard me yelling at him to get out, not to take my purse. I grabbed a knife that was a long serrated knife. It was a bread knife because I thought I would scare him out of my apartment. It had, in fact, worked before that I was able to scare him into leaving me alone. He approached me when he couldn't find my wallet in my purse, and I had the knife, and it started to scratch him, in fact. It didn't scare him. And that terrified me. He was getting more angry, and so I agreed to give him my wallet. When I put the knife away and looked for my wallet, it wasn't where I normally kept it, in my scrub pants. And I pleaded with him that I didn't know where it was, and he didn't believe me. And he was coming at me again, and I was terrified that he was going to now choke me to death. And I grabbed another knife out of my kitchen drawer. And as he was coming toward me, he stumbled. I don't know if it was because he was drunk or he stumbled on things that were on the floor. When he stumbled, he impaled himself on the knife that I was holding for my protection because I had a right to defend myself. And that wound proved to be very grievous. It went into his lung, punctured his lung, and he did not survive that.
Tracy McCarter, you called 911?
Yes. I immediately began screaming for someone to call 911. And in fact, myself got my phone and called 911. A neighbor came into the apartment and helped me to talk to 911 while I was trying to put pressure on the wound. As a nurse, I knew that was the only hope he had, was to just keep pressure on that wound. And I was desperate to do that. I talked to the 911 operator. My first words to the 911 operator was that I stabbed my husband on accident, because in my mind, that's exactly what had happened. An accident had just happened. But I also go on to say that I was being attacked. The neighbor was yelling at me, asking me, what did I do? The 911 operator was querying me about what did I do? And I told them that I had, in fact, been attacked. Then shortly thereafter, the police came into my apartment, and then EMS. And I was forced away from helping to save his life, put in handcuffs. And I watched the police try to perform CPR on my husband, not putting pressure on the wound, and was forced to watch them pump the blood out of his body even faster than it was already going, and they wouldn't listen to me when I was trying to tell them how to save his life.
So, Tracy, you end up being taken to Rikers. I think this piece that you just won a major award for, the Truesat Center for Grassroots Journalism Award, is a black woman accused of killing a white man. I was never innocent until proven guilty. Did you see race as playing a major role here in determining you being imprisoned at Riker for, what, half a year?
Mm-hmm. You know, at first, I didn't. I mean, I didn't think of myself as black and Jim as white. I was just the person who loved Jim. And a few months into being at Rikers, I remember being on the phone with a friend, and I said to her, oh, my God, I'm still here because Jim is white. They don't see me as a nurse. They don't see me as a person who had loving relationships with people, who was a good mother, who had never been in trouble. I was simply being viewed as a black woman who had killed a white man. And, you know, that was played out and confirmed for me on April 30th, 2020. I was in a bail hearing, requesting bail. And I thought, you know, they just don't know what happened. They just don't know how dangerous Jim was. And there was this video that I had ended up getting on my phone of him. And I told my lawyer, let them go on my phone, look at this video. And when ADA Sarah Sullivan sees this video, she's going to understand. And I'm going to be going home. And so what happened was, on in court that day, instead, what ADA Sarah Sullivan says about that video was that, you know, it appeared that Jim was, he was attacking me. He was yelling at me. He was in my face yelling at me, not attacking me. And at some point, he comes up and he starts to pull my hair. And the phone goes down. And it's not entirely clear, but it appears that he may have choked me. But it would have been for a short time. And I thought, excuse me? What do you, like, you can't choke someone. There's no, we know that from all of the, you know, the fact that police can't put people in chokeholds anymore. There is no safe amount of time to choke anyone. And so this was an ADA in the domestic violence division who should be extremely aware that strangulation is the most dangerous form of domestic violence. And instead, she was saying that he was allowed to choke me for this brief time without being a big deal. And I want to be clear, that video was not from the night that I was attacked. It was from a night, the time before I left him. And that's what convinced me I had to leave. And so, you know, he only got worse over time. And so it became clear to me that I wasn't going to be considered a person whose life was important enough to defend. And I can only make the assumption that it is because I am a black woman. And as Miriam Kaba, a very famous abolitionist and activist in this work, tells us, we don't have selves to defend us, you know, brown and black women. And that the court makes that very clear.
So you are put in Rikers at the height of the COVID pandemic. You're a nurse. You have this remarkable history. You had four kids by the time you were 20. You were accepted to Yale University. You couldn't go because you couldn't afford it. You were at the time, getting your master's degree at Columbia, but you're in Rikers, and a movement starts to grow. This grassroots movement led by Survived and Punished. If you can talk about the significance of the people who fought for your case to be known, and ultimately, one of the men who would stand with you was running for district attorney. You talked about the ADA against you, but Alvin Bragg, and he tweeted, hashtag, I stand with Tracy, and he ultimately won, though it would take a year before he would drop the murder charges against you, Tracy. The significance of that activism.
I want to be very clear that my case was started under Cy Vance and continued under Alvin Bragg. And so prosecutors aren't different just because there's a new one, what I saw, not from what I saw. And so there was this group of people who started by just sending me a letter at Rikers. And I had no idea at the time that anyone other than my family and my lawyers knew I was at Rikers. And it said, we have this information about other women. We have expertise that we can leverage to help you. Will you allow us to do that? And so I consented, and they contacted my family. They helped us to understand the court process because my lawyer, my first lawyer, wasn't very good at doing that, I felt. And so they also started talking about how to get this case, you know, in the media. How do we get people to understand what is happening to me? And my lawyers aren't very pleased with these things. They want decorum, right? We're supposed to just follow the rules. And the rules say you don't talk about your case prior to, you know, appearing in court. But after 6 months at Rikers, I knew this was my only hope to get out of there. And so they started to meet weekly with my family on the outside. I wasn't initially involved with meeting with them weekly. But when I got out, we started to meet. They were the ones that got Victoria Law interested in my case, and because of her, she wrote a story, and it was picked up by the Wall Street Journal. And I quite frankly think it embarrassed the office of Cy Vance, and that is the only reason I was allowed to leave Rikers on an electronic monitor. And as you say, there was this campaign going for a new district attorney. Cy Vance was not going to run again, and several of the candidates made some sort of comment about my case, but Alvin Bragg made a very strong statement that, you know, domestic violence survivors should not be prosecuted for acts of self-defense. So when he was elected in the fall of 2021, we thought, okay, well, he's heard the story. He knows, you know, some of the facts. My lawyers asked, can we have a meeting with him to give him all the facts? I actually had a meeting where I sat down for 2 hours in his office and explained to him exactly what happened, the history of my relationship, and walked him through that night. They had access to all of our evidence, to our experts. They were allowed to talk to, they had our entire case. And what happened instead was he offered me a plea. And I was not willing to take a plea. They did get it down to an Alford plea that was, you know, would allow me to keep my license. And by that time, I was on the record as being suicidal. I needed desperately to get to treatment. And so I said, fine, if I can take an Alford plea, which is one in which you do not have to say you're guilty because I'm not guilty of a crime, and it would end in a repleader where it would be a misdemeanor at the end of a year and I would get to keep my nursing license, fine, I'll take it. And we go to court, and Judge Kiesel, who had my case in front of her, said absolutely not. She would not take it because it was, her words were, speaking to the prosecutor, you charged her with murder. And you want this, like, and saying, like, you want this to end in a misdemeanor? She said that it was indicated it was too lenient and she was not going to take it. Now, by this time,
which was absolutely amazing because she was known as an advocate
every time
for
I had to go to court every 60 days.
So I want to bring into this conversation Brooklyn College law professor Jocelyn Simonson, who has written the book Radical Acts of Courage, How Ordinary People Are Dismantling Incarceration. Professor Simonson, if you can talk about how it was this grassroots movement that ultimately pushed Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA's office, to drop the murder charges entirely.
Sure. Good morning. Thank you for having me. So you played some audio earlier of Alvin Bragg asking Judge Kiesel to dismiss the case. But that only happened after he was in office for nearly a year, not keeping his promise to dismiss the charges against Tracy. And what you can't see when we hear the audio is that courtroom was absolutely full of people wearing red T-shirts and red hoodies that said two things on it. One was stand with Tracy, because this group had collectively worked both to support Tracy and to let the public know about her case. And it also said free them all, because Survived and Punished New York is a group that works with individuals on their collective defense campaigns, but also connects what's happening to the larger criminalization of survivors, and especially of Black women. And so this group was able to support Tracy, to let the public know what was happening, and to connect what was happening to larger beliefs in the injustice of what was happening. And that's what my book talks about different ways that people are collectively helping people who are being criminalized, and by doing so, actually showing that there are other understandings of justice and safety. In Tracy's case, that justice would have been not arresting her in the first place, but rather supporting her during a trauma that is unimaginable to so many of us.
And we're going to continue this discussion after the broadcast and post it at democracynow.org. You're listening to Jocelyn Simonson, law professor at Brooklyn College. Her new book is called Radical Acts of Justice, How Ordinary People Are Dismantling Incarceration. We're also going to continue talking with Tracy McCarter, domestic violence survivor, nurse, and grandmother. She just graduated from Columbia University. I'm Amy Goodman. Tune into Democracy Now! Happy birthday to Paul Powell.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.